From KCRW and KCRW.com, this is Left, Right, and Center.
You like potato?
And you like potato?
You like tomato?
And you like tomato?
Potato?
Potato?
Tomato?
Tomato?
Let's call a potato.
The Syrian Shift, the latest on Edward Snowden and the NSA, plus crunch time on immigration. Hello again and welcome to Left, Right, and Center, your civilized yet provocative antidote to the self-contained opinion bubbles that dominate political debate. I'm Matt Miller, your moderator holding down the political center, coming to you from NPR in New York City today. Robert Scheer is on the left in Santa Monica. Rich Lowry on the right from Washington, D.C. today. He's the editor of National Review, columnist for Politico, and author of the hit new book, Lincoln Unbound. Welcome all from across the country, across the really is like a bicoastal, tricoastal, impressively diverse set of locations today. Syria atop the news as we went to air. Barack Obama having shifted gears, Bob, with the announcement that he's going to provide. I mean, it sounds like something, the idea that doing something is better than nothing, but it's not much. Providing small arms to the rebels, discussion maybe of offering some kind of anti-tank weaponry. This is after, I guess my question is, what is it now? I mean, 90,000 people have been killed by Assad in this last couple years, I guess. What is it about the 100 to 150 now that they feel has been confirmed to have been killed by sarin gas that means now you've done something unacceptable and the United States as a great power is going to act? What do you make of it?
Well, I don't think the United States can be trusted to act as a great power from a human rights point of view because we've been so inconsistent. And the real contradiction in Syria is that the good guys, if we're going to arm them now, are people that we otherwise blast as Islamic fanatics and people causing a lot of trouble in the world, particularly with the Sunni base. And so I think you're up against, you know, if you're going to intervene in countries, you have to be consistent. It has to be a genocidal situation. People have to be able to trust your information. You have to do it in concert with others whose information is trusted. And it should be done very, very sparingly. And it seems to me what we're seeing here is that if you win, you lose because the very people that you've been demonizing will be brought to power. And actually, the government that was in power in Syria was relatively secular and one that actually we had cooperated with as well as Israel had.
Rich, what do you make of these developments?
Well, I think Bob's basic point about the risk of bringing to power people we won't be particularly happy with has some force. We're going to try to arm the more moderate elements of the opposition, but that's easier said than done, and it would have been easier probably a year or two ago before the conflict had worn on and the opposition got radicalized. I kind of think that this is not a case of the administration determining that Syria used chemical weapons and therefore deciding to arm the rebels. I think it was the other way around. They decided they wanted to arm the rebels, and therefore they made the determination, which does not mean that it was made up or that Syria didn't indeed use these weapons. It's just that they could have dragged out their study and investigation into the use of these weapons as long as they wanted. So I think they decided finally to arm the rebels because they're losing, and it's galling and bad for our interest to see Assad winning this civil war. And the assumption was, I think, on the part of the administration and a lot of other folks on the outside, is just that he was on his last legs and it was inevitable he was going to go one way or the other. And given the kind of support he's seen from Russia and from Hezbollah forces on the ground, that belied that assumption. So we were basically losing a proxy war that we weren't quite involved in yet, but the side we tend to support was losing. So now we're going to give them weapons. It's a fairly minimal step. I would oppose doing anything more. A no-fly zone, people always talk about in these situations on the assumption it's kind of a sterile thing. It's not. It basically means you're all in and you take responsibility for the force in opposition to the government and you just have to win. And I wouldn't want us to be in that spot.
You know, Bob, just to toss a couple things into the mix, I was reading a little just before we went on air. And by the way, as we went to air on Friday, you know, Assad was pressing. There was a new offensive in Aleppo against the major Syrian city, against the, you know, the most intense fighting in months, apparently, as Assad's trying to press his advantage. And James Traub, a foreign policy analyst I admire, writes for the New York Times Magazine a lot, does a blog for Foreign Policy Magazine, had a very quick column out. He'd been talking to national security aides around the time that they had made this decision in the White House. And the sense, Bob, was that this really was at the very minimal end of what you might do. You know, one aide saying maybe this will change the emotional balance, that the, you know, that the, it'll create some sense of hope among the rebels, but that it's not enough to really do much to really change the situation on the ground. Others saying that President Clinton, who on Thursday this week made some comments that some are saying may have been at least part of the backdrop of what influenced Obama, even though they've been discussing this for weeks. And there was this great quote that Clinton had, you know, I guess reflecting on his own failure to act in Rwanda years ago, where he said in some public appearance this week, he said, this is a quote, Clinton, "If you refuse to act and you cause a calamity, you can't excuse yourself later by saying, oh, my God, 2 years ago, there was a poll that said 80% of you were against it."
Yeah, look, I think, and this relates to the next subject we're going to talk about, secrecy and information. You know, we had this poison gas issue with Saddam Hussein. And the fact is, he used it against his people before he had his alliance with the United States, which we made because we wanted him to be a proxy warrior against Iran. And you have the famous picture of Donald Rumsfeld shaking hands with him after he had used what we describe as this terrible weapon. It is a terrible weapon, but it's interesting when we decide to panic about it. Then, when we decided we were going to go against him, we fabricated information about that. So what I'm saying is, you know, you should not be intervening anywhere in the world if you're not serious, if you're not consistent, and if you don't have a strong moral position. I would also remind, I remember being in the Golan Heights a half century ago, you know, in this time of the Six-Day War. I've visited these areas. I've seen what claims are made. The fact that we have not been able, with all of our efforts, to bring about a resolution, a satisfactory human rights resolution to the Palestinian-Israeli issue, and yet we're still meddling, and we all know that issue is absolutely critical to the instability of that region, I think shows that we're not serious, and we go in usually for domestic political reasons to score one advantage of one political party over the other.
Any last thoughts, Rich?
The Clinton comments, I think, are key. Not necessarily that, you know, that was the advice that he was giving President Obama and therefore it swayed him. I just think Clinton was thinking not just about Rwanda but about the Balkans, where he hesitated for so long because he didn't want to bother. His attention was on domestic matters. He didn't think the public was enthusiastic about it, which it wasn't. But as it dragged on and on and on, it undermined his credibility here at home somewhat as commander-in-chief, and it also undermined the international credibility of the United States. And I think that's the dynamic that President Clinton was focused on in those remarks. And I think that has to at least be some factor on the part of Barack Obama here. And this dispute, though, I disagree with Bob, I don't think has anything to do with the Israeli-Palestinian conflict, really. I mean, this is an inter-Arab sectarian civil war in large part. And, you know, one of the tragedies of the Arab Spring, which some of us were hopeful about, I was cautiously hopeful about, is there seems to be no good guys, and you get what you get, basically. We've found over the last year or so is your choice of different kinds of dictatorship.
Let us know what you think about the U.S. decision to help in some ways the Syrian rebels at kcrw.com/LRC. Edward Snowden, Robert Scheer, this all broke after our last show. A full week of news and revelations and hearings on the Hill. What do you make of the Snowden move and where we are now in this entire saga, Robert Scheer?
Well, I think, you know, I read your column this week. I hope you read mine. We have a very serious disagreement. I think what Snowden did is very valuable. I think we had every right to have this information. Our government had lied to us about what it was doing, that he did a great public service in letting us know what our government does. And we can defend it, we can argue about it, but the idea that we should be kept ignorant of what our government does, and that makes us stronger, I don't think can ever be justified. And I think that's a position the New York Times has taken editorially and a number of other papers, and I agree with it. The point I would like to take issue with in your column, and I commend people to read it, you bring up a very good example, I think, of what with the problem is, the difference of experience of maybe ordinary people and pundits. You say, to test Big Brother's reach, my daughter and I emailed on how to work with a Chechen rebel group to develop weapons for an attack on U.S. soil as part of a play we're writing based on recent events. No knock at the door.
That's a heck of a school project,
okay,
Matt.
No, but think about think if you had a different name. Think if you were a Muslim. Think of the people who've been, you know, under rendition, sent without any notice. You happen to be well-placed. You're a public person. You would get a lot of support if you were just arrested. But the fact is, this would be considered a crime, discussing with your daughter an email about engaging in a terrorist attack. In fact, our government has said it has the right to arrest you and send you to a place like Libya to be tortured if you do that. So I think part of the discussion here is that we never think we're going to be on the receiving end of this information is gathered. The other thing I would like to take issue with you is you say NSA has never made profit from this. Google and these other people make profits. There's two points. NSA has made profit. The guy who was our chief intelligence person is now head of Booz Allen, to whom this work was contracted, a large part of it. Clapper was with Booz Allen. He's now the chief intelligence person. So the revolving door between the Defense Department and NSA and the private sector, it moves very quickly, and these people make an enormous amount of money off it. But there is also, and our Constitution recognizes, a difference between what the government should be allowed to do and what private business can do. You can deal with private businesses. They don't have the power of the military and the police to come and break into your house and send you to another country.
Rich, why don't you share your thoughts and reactions, and then I'll dig in as well.
Why don't you stick up for yourself, Matt? Come on, be a man. Don't just like throw it over to me.
Be a man. Well, the only thing I'd say, Bob, first is on the email I sent to my daughter, I said it was a quote unquote play that we were working on, so that we weren't actually doing we weren't actually plotting a terrorist attack. It was a tongue in cheek way to test the reach of Big Brother that my daughter and I shared. If you want, Rich, I'm happy to weigh in.
I'm just kidding. Go ahead, then I'll jump in. Well, I've broken out on, in considering these sort of matters, the shear meter, which is if you're a zero on the meter, it means you sleep soundly at night, you're not worried at all about the surveillance state, you're happy for the NSA to tuck you in, you know, and fluff your pillow. If it's a 10, you're manning the barricades as the dark night of fascism arrives. And I think last week I was probably a 2 or 3 on the shear meter. I think I've ticked up a little bit. I think I'm a 3 or a 4. And I think it gets to this issue of secrecy, where I'm not quite where Bob is, but it's beginning to make some more sense to me what he's saying here. It's when you have a program like this that's so vast, that has so many implications, it's going on as a matter of routine for years. There should be more debate about it than we had. And I do not believe, I'm not one of these conservatives that believes the Obama regime did this just because they're so hostile to our liberties and have some dire plot. He did it because he sat down in the chair and got the intelligence briefings and realized the nature of the threat and realized that this in his mind, this program was useful. And the Obama administration is right, you know, that there are checks. You get the FISA court. Congress is aware of it, at least the folks on the intelligence committees, and it's written there in the law, you know, in the Patriot Act. But all three of those checks are kind of attenuated because, as we, you know, learn, the FISA court approves most of these things almost as a matter of course, it seems. Sure, the members of the Intelligence Committee know about it, but does the rest of Congress know about it? Does the public really know about it? Well, no. And any layman reading that Section 215 of the Patriot Act would not have any guess in a million years that what it was referring to was this. So I'm not a fan of Snowden. I'm not a fan of what he did. But I do think, as a matter of small-d democratic hygiene, this should be debated publicly, and the secrecy was unwarranted. I understand, and I'm very sympathetic to the government when it says, you know, we have a covert operation somewhere or a double agent and it can't be revealed, and pleads with the press not to report on that sort of thing. And I generally side with the government there, but I don't see how the revelation of just the very existence of this program has to compromise anything at all. And it will enable us, I think, to have a fair and full debate about it and decide whether we want to tighten it up, keep it the way it is, or change some other way.
So let me jump in. So first, I love the shear meter. What a great innovation! How come we didn't do that on the show before? And it also reflects the kind of nuanced, you know, evolution of your thinking from week to week on this stuff, which I admire and is also fun. I mean, I'm all for having the debate on this. My quarrel with Snowden is the idea that first, there's the kind of grandiosity, which I wrote about in the Washington Post column, that, you know, is a self-appointed, you know, 29-year-old in Hawaii who feels frustrated with a program that's not some rogue program, the kind of Ludlam-like secret government within a government thing. This was a program that had been enacted, had congressional involvement, had court involvement. You can quarrel, and I understand. And other, senators I admire, like Ron Wyden, have raised questions about all of this. But Snowden had a range of options to him other than deciding on his own to dump all this information. And it sounds like, you know, as we went to air on Friday, there may be many more things he's disclosing. He's disclosing hacking, apparently, that the U.S. has done with the Chinese. So the idea that the only option was this kind of publicity-seeking, quote-unquote, martyrdom while he flees to Hong Kong, as opposed to other avenues he could have taken to get public attention, press attention, or more congressional oversight on this, I think is flawed. And I think the idea of romanticizing him as a hero, as opposed to the anonymous people, same age, computer-talented people who may have signed up after 9/11 to serve their country and have spent years with thousands of people and billions of dollars developing programs that are trying to find, as one analyst said this week, if you're trying to find the needle in the haystack, you need the haystack. The idea that data mining goes on in the service of trying to do this, I think we would be outraged as a public if more 9/11s happened or anything on that kind of scale and the government hadn't been trying to avail itself of all of this. We need to take a quick break. Up ahead, more on Snowden and the implications and the fight and the shear meter, plus more on immigration and economic jitters. You're listening to Left, Right, and Center.
Listen to Left, Right, and Center on one of KCRW's mobile apps or leave a comment on our Facebook page. And be sure to check out Matt Miller's new podcast at kcrw.com/thisisinteresting or wherever you download podcasts.
Have you checked out the KCRW iPad app? It's called The Music Mine. Stream music handpicked by our DJs, watch live performances, and find new music. See why iTunes calls it an essential app for music discovery. Download and learn more at kcrw.com/musicmine.
Back again with Left, Right, and Center. I'm Matt Miller of The Washington Post, Robert Scheer of TruthDig.com, Rich Lowry of National Review Politico, and his exciting new book, Lincoln Unbound. Robert Scheer of the Scheer. I'm still dwelling on the range of, what was it, zero? Was NSA tucks you in with your pillow and a mint, and then 10 is the dark night of fascism has descended. Bob, take it where you will.
You guys are really pleased with yourself. Where is the...
we're having a little fun,
me, I'm just,
Bob.
I know you're having
fun.
A little fun, but you're trivializing an argument. I don't think it's a shear meter.
Oh,
I think
Bob, I really did not mean to trivialize it at all.
Frankly, I think it's a constitutional meter. I think it's where you could have it, the George Washington meter or the Jefferson meter. You could have the Brandeis meter. Well, we have to take some of these issues seriously. People do get killed. I
mean,
shall we begin on a serious note then? What I'm suggesting is your attitude towards government is very basic to your view of how freedom is sustained or subverted. And the assumption of our Constitution, our founders had enemies. They had risks. They risked their lives for this country and to make a revolution, and they knew they would be hanged if they lost. And yet they put this provision of the Fourth Amendment and other provisions in our Constitution to restrict the power of the state because they based it on the king. And they said a republic that has that kind of power will not remain free. And you will always have national security threats. They had national security threats when they wrote our Constitution. And the whole idea of having private space against the state, and it's not the same when Yahoo or Google does it, because presumably they're operating in the market and you have choices as consumer and so forth. It's a very different thing when your government can have this kind of detailed information on your every movement, your every conversation. And one mistake you make in your column, by the way, is you're ignoring the role of these supercomputers and networking and so forth. You say no one can sift through this information. That's not true. The fact of the matter is they can profile people and they can hound them. And they can ferret out people. And that point was made by the CEO of Google in his new book, where he said totalitarian regimes armed with these kind of modern techniques that are on the shelf and available can suppress movements like the Arab Spring or any other movement that rises up. So the power of government, the unbridled power of government, is something our founders alerted us to, and we should not trivialize. And then the fact that there's profit made in this, that these people go in and out of government, and this happened with the banking meltdown, it happens with a lot of this, should shock you, it should alarm you, because it's not true. It's all self-interested. And I want to last one other point. You quote Daniel Ellsberg saying Snowden's a hero. Well, Daniel Ellsberg knows something about a hero. He was willing to sacrifice his career, just like Snowden has done. Very few people are willing to sacrifice their career. And he was willing to alert us to the fact that the government had lied to us about Vietnam and had kept the basic record of that war from us. Well, what happened here? And most of the commentators have accepted. This adds to the debate. Why did it remain for Snowden? Why didn't Dianne Feinstein tell us about this? Why didn't all the other folks in government who knew about this? Why didn't the folks who knew they lied about Iraq when they lied and convinced you Iraq was made sense? Why didn't they quit over this? That's the standard. If you want a meter, what's the Miller meter? That you go along and keep your mouth shut and don't reveal the truth?
No, Bob, that you don't violate your oath not to reveal national security secrets
even
when you take
when it's a
job
a war crime,
working for the
even
government
lying,
in
even,
the security administration.
But then where is the Nuremberg principle? Where is the idea of truth?
Bob, we disagree on how we see this situation. We're not going to resolve it here. We disagree on how we see Snowden. You think he's a hero. I don't. Period. I mean, I think people understand the axis of debate.
No, but you raised the question. The question is, you said you go along because you have an oath. Now, Ellsberg took an oath. But the fact is, he said, I think our government is committing a war crime and they're keeping information the public has rights. So I have, under the principle of Nuremberg, on the idea of individual responsibility, I need to blow the whistle. You're not giving any credit. You're not giving credit to the whistleblowers.
I don't view Snowden as a whistleblower. I view him as he had many other avenues open to him. And I think the idea that a 29-year-old can negate the work of when there's Congress, the White House, the courts involved in this. I mean, people understand the axis of debate, Bob. We disagree. I think the country disagrees. People hear that. Rich, do you want to have a last word on this?
Yeah, well, a key question is just where does the expectation of privacy begin and end, right? I mean, the courts have held you write something on the outside of the envelope, you put it in a box put there by the government, and the government delivers it. There's no expectation of privacy for what you wrote on that envelope. And this kind of telephony data is often times called, envelope information, because the argument is that's basically analogous to that. I work with a former prosecutor named Andy McCarthy, who says they used to kind of razz interns or young lawyers in the office by saying, we got this case, it's so important, it's so wide-ranging, I need every single phone number in the city of New York to pursue this case, can you get me that? And the kid would blanch and say, oh my gosh, yeah, that's unbelievable. That's so sweeping. Is that constitutional? And then Andy, whoever the prosecutor was, would grab and reach for the phone book, of course. So every single phone number is a matter of public record. So again, the question is whether these digits that you punch in and that go to a third party, whether you have the same expectation of privacy that you do for an actual conversation. And the courts have said no. So again, I agree with Bob. It's important to have this debate. But I hesitate to use the phrase sheer meter again, because I guess you should be retired if it, in deference to Bob, if it offends him.
No, but it flatters.
I think getting to a 10 is way disproportionate.
Well, if you use it in a flattering way to say you respect the Constitution, you fear the power of big brother and big government, which is, after all, the whole assumption of our republic, fine, I'm flattered to have to identify with that. And by the way, I would point out this is not a left-right issue. First of all, as far as the center, I agree exactly with the New York Times position. And others have taken, but there are plenty of people on the conservative side who have a profound respect for civil liberty and are frightened of big government. This used to inform, in fact, the Republican Party, as you have mentioned earlier. I think even if your founder, William Buckley, were around, he might be sympathetic to that point of view. I think a fear of big government and a day when you can have this kind of detailed information on people's reading habits, their lives, what they're doing, who they're hanging out with, and that doesn't frighten you. I think it would have frightened Buckley, and I think he might have agreed with me on this.
And my whole point, we got about a minute and a half left, and I want to hit immigration, Rich, in 1 second, is that, is I think you really conflated, Bob, we could do a whole other show on this, the idea of some ex-government people who cash in when they go to the private sector is a very different matter than the fact that the same kind of data mining and algorithmizing and monetizing our private data is done in ways that I don't think most people understand when they're on Google, Facebook, all these other services. And if that were known just for informational purposes, I think there will be increasing frustration and outrage about the way our private data is used to make billions of dollars for a very small group of people. But we can come back to that. Rich, any quick thoughts on immigration? Because we got about a minute before we ramp. But that debate did hit the floor this week. The Senate, I mean, this is it. Immigration reform is happening or not, right, in the next next 6 weeks.
Yeah, next couple of weeks. It looks like it's in pretty good shape in the Senate. Everyone seems to think it's right around 60, and the question is whether they can get what I would consider some sort of fig leaf on enforcement to get it up to 70 and really pressure the House. And so in that case, and it looks like that's where we're going to end up, it all falls on John Boehner and where he wants to go on this, and it looks like, you know, he's very, very favorably inclined to the legislation.
Bob, just 20 seconds till we rant. Any quick thoughts on immigration? You want to come back to it and we'll just rant.
Well, I certainly think we need immigration reform, and I think if the Republicans have any sense of their future and logical, they'll come out for it, and I suspect we are going to get some movement ahead.
Will be fascinating if we see that. I mean, this basically looks like it's this summer is the do or die time for that. We have reached our time once again for our famed end of show, Left, Right, and Center Rant, featuring pet peeves from across the ideological spectrum, about 30 seconds-ish each. Rich Lowry, your soapbox.
I'm going to have a self-interested rant as a new author of the book Lincoln Unbound and rant about Lincoln and how both progressives and an element of the right mischaracterize him, portray him as the father of big government when he wasn't anything of the sort. He did have a positive view of government, but at a time when government was much smaller, we had no welfare state, we didn't have regulation the way we do now, we didn't have bureaucracy the way we do now, and it was all about fostering market dynamism and the opportunity for people to rise. And the proper understanding of Abraham Lincoln is that he was the foremost apostle of opportunity in American history.
Hear, hear. Robert Scheer.
Yeah, I do want to add one more point about this. Careerism trumping everything. I think it's a disease of our time. People want to go along to get along, and they go along with stuff they shouldn't object to. And thank God for the whistleblowers who tell us what we need to know. Let us debate the issues. If we left it up to the Dianne Feinsteins, we never would have even known about this program. They just sell out all the time.
Well, I'm going to change my rant. I think one of the dividing lines between someone like Bob and I, Bob, I respect your view and where it is on the Scheer meter, but I do think there's, and I think there is an inevitable tension and balance that needs to be struck and restruck over time between security concerns, which are real, and privacy concerns and liberty concerns, which are as real. And I think I'm colored in my view by the fact, having served in government, I empathize with the good work of thousands of people who are trying to keep us safe. I observe lots of them in kind of close contact, and the idea that one person off on his own in Hawaii, who in my view is a kind of grandiose, immature individual who was not just looking out for the public good, but had some other personal agenda that's hard to fully understand, is not to be honored in a situation like this, but instead to be critiqued and to label anyone who discloses information that makes you aware of something that you're glad to know about a whistleblower, I think does disservice to whistleblowers in the best sense. That's all the whistleblowing we have time for today on Left, Right, and Center. Thanks, as always, to Robert Scheer, Rich Lowry, and our technical director, who is J.C. Swadek. Laura Dine Milliam produced today's program. A big thanks to Manoli Weatherell here at NPR in New York City. I'm Matt Miller. Thanks for listening. Tune in again next week for more Left, Right, and Center.
Download the podcast from KCRW.com or from iTunes and share your comments at KCRW.com/LRC. Left, Right, and Center is produced and distributed by KCRW.